Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 307 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the second part of a two-part interview, Mirza Wahid speaks with Anne Morgan about why non-Western literature shouldn't have to explain itself to Western readers, who can tell which stories, how parenthood and being primary carer has affected him as a writer, and the secret joy of working on buses. You can hear the first part of this interview in the preceding episode 306.
Mirza Wahid is a novelist who delights in exploring dangerous territory. From corpse pickers to punishment surgeons, his characters inhabit shady worlds in which right and wrong are often hard to discern. Born and raised in Kashmir, and now living in the UK, Mirza has been a finalist for several literary prizes, including the Guardian First Book Award, the Shakti Bhatt First Book Prize, and the DSC Prize for South Asian Literature. His first novel, The Collaborator, was an international bestseller. I meet him in his home in North London, intrigued to find out more. Arundhati Roy said that she doesn't wish to be seen as an interpreter of the East to the West. Your books have been read around the world, and one of the things I really enjoyed about your writing is the fact that you don't actually go out of your way to explain a lot of things, or you don't seem to. Maybe it's something you've considered carefully, but I wonder how much you think about the readership, whether there is a readership somewhere in your mind, or whether it is a global readership, or are you writing for yourself? Who are you writing for?
I write for my wife. No. That's a joke. No, you see, but the thing is, it's not a conscious decision that, oh, I'm not going to explain anything. But, you know, when you read, and we are, you know, Anglophone literature, and, you know, when I studied literature in university, and you read the great novels, and, you know, you read Dickens, and I read the classics. No, the question is not asked, you know. Is there enough explanation for the non-English reader, you know, in those novels? You know, the question is not even, doesn't even come up. It doesn't arise. Is there enough background on Victorian era England in those novels for the non-English person in South Asia, growing up in South Asia, to make sense? It's not even asked. You're supposed to work on it. You're supposed to work and get it. And we do. So it never arises. The question for me doesn't arise, or do I put in enough explanation? But if the question is asked, I say no. So, for instance, there was a major publisher, who I shall not name, who wanted to publish The Collaborator in the US many years ago. You know, major, major publisher in America. And I received this wonderful phone call from this editor, who was very, very good, and the editor said, you know, we love it, and, you know, it's one of the best things we've read, so on and so, usual sort of thing. And we were wondering if you could do a couple of pages of historical background at the beginning of the novel, you know, weave it in at the beginning of the novel for American readers to understand, you know. I said no, because I said I'm not writing a history tutorial. It's a novel, you know, which meant the book was not published in the US. But I don't make a big deal out of this, because it is not a big deal. I mean, you can either say yes or no. You're not comfortable with it. I'm not going to write a tutorial about history at the beginning of the novel, you know. But does one become sort of this, you know, rigid figure, rigid person? No. My publishers here in the UK, Penguin, Viking said, they wanted a map before the novel starts. That was fine. A map of where this novel takes place. And at the end they wanted some figures about what has happened in this place. I said, yeah. It didn't interfere with it didn't take anything away from the novel. In fact, actually, later on I thought it contained the novel very well. Big geography, history, space and numbers. You know, where and what. In the middle is this fictional sort of thing. That was fine. But you want to write a bit of history lesson because the readers are not bothered to... No.
There have been a lot of debates about authenticity in writing and who has the right to tell which stories. You're very brave in the subjects you take on. Are there any subject areas that you wouldn't, as a writer, want to tackle or dare to tackle?
Yeah, British politics right now.
There are plenty of people trying to tackle that.
You know, it's fascinating. Yeah, but it's just so depressing right now, and so terrifying for people like us. You know, because I mean, we live in London, which is brilliant and cosmopolitan and diverse, and so on and so forth. The rest of the country is fine as well, but it has unleashed certain, you know, things that you didn't know existed. How do I frame this? Let me put it this way. So you write women, for instance, as a male writer, right? And characters. You've known women all your life, you know, from your family to friends and your own family, or the women you loved. Or, you know. And then you think, okay, you can do it. But it's actually more difficult. I have learned over the years, you know. It's more difficult than that also. It's not that you have to be the same gender, yeah? But you haven't had enough experience, or you haven't known enough, or you haven't thought about it enough because of how you, you know, live and how you brought up. And which meant, okay, but you can work on it. You can work harder, or you can spend more time. So my way of doing this was, I spend more time. You know, if I have to write a woman, a female character, you would rather spend more time with the character so that you can try to inhabit the mind fully as to the extent possible. And spending enough time with characters means you begin to hear them. And that's how I like to work. You have to hear them. It's never fully formed. You know, it's not like, oh, it's crystal clear. It's not. But with time, you begin to hear faint echoes of a voice. And then you spend more time, then you begin to hear more. And then comes a point, and you think, okay, it rings true. I've been reading more women of late, because I thought, you know, this is, you know, when you grow up, it's so unwitting, it's so unconscious that, you know, when you're growing up, all the major writers you're given to read are men. So it takes a lot, it's not a re-education, but a reckoning of sorts, that because you have to, you know, you shake your head and say, oh my God, you read all these big writers, many of them are men. What happened? Then you go back to early childhood or teenage and you feel, okay, this is why it happened. There was no people, when they gave you books, they were men, you know. And then as a writer, it is a big hole.
Women writers are often asked about the effect of the pram in the hallway on writing, but how has parenthood affected you as a writer?
Oh, man. I like to joke that I, you know, I look after my daughter full time and my son full time, and I write when she allows it, my daughter. But now she's four, so my last novel, the Tell Her Everything, it was exactly as old as Layla, my daughter. I started making loose notes, you know, you think of something, you put it down somewhere, before, when my wife was pregnant with our daughter. So when she was born, obviously, you know, things, the universe changes completely. It's not what it was 2 days ago. It's been upended and, you know, it's turned upside down and so on and so forth. But it's, you know, it's a delightful, beautiful, wonderful thing to be a parent, a primary carer. And it's hard, you know, but it took me some time to understand that actually I don't have time. It took me some time, even when she started going to the babysitter, that, oh, you don't have the day. Your head thinks you got the day free now, but you have to do the school run at 3:30. So 10 to 3 is 5 hours or something, during which there's also all your rituals and, you know, your chores and things like that. So it took me 6 to 8 months to recognize you don't have a full day, Waheed. You have a few hours. So make use of them. But even so, I'm not a very disciplined writer. You know, I'm not, like, brilliant with time management. It took me a while, you know. Then you have to relearn how to write in the time that's available. Because otherwise, you know, what happens with most writers I know is you wait for this lovely chunk of time to arrive, that I'm going to start and embark on this big project when I have, you know. That's, with kids, that's not going to come. So it took me a while to register that, to internalize that. That's not going to come, you know. The 3 years exclusively on a, it's not going to happen, right? So then you say, okay, what's the next best thing? Or what's the next? So you then begin to learn how to write in, you know, these chunks of time. That's how I wrote the Tell Her Everything. I wrote it in chunks, and then, you know, one day I got it all together and printed it off, went on a bus. I like buses for reading. And yeah, I did a few bus journeys and read all of it. You know, it's when you do want to do sustained reading, you know, when you want to hold a project in your hands and see how much is slipping through the fingers.
So you ride around on buses?
I would love to do more of it, but I don't have the time. But I love it, is what I'm going to say. I don't do it as a habit. But if you, for instance, go from stop A to Z on a bus, there's a certain rhythm to it, and you can, you know, just, I like it.
And when you're reading those manuscripts, are you marking, making notes?
I become better. I used to be very bad. I would take the pen from the very first page, from the very first reading, you know. But that kind of reading means you're not really reading the thing in its entirety. You're looking at the words and the sentences and everything, which is important. But the first read has to be, you know. I mean, some people do it the other way around, you know. That you fix the text to the extent possible, to the best of your ability, and then you read the whole thing. But the bus ride helps in because you're there and the bus is going and it's an hour or something. You read sustained in terms of the story, the arc, and you know what's happening.
That's a good tip. I might have to try that.
It's lovely because it's also cheap.
It's great, yeah.
Because you sit on a bus, you spend £1.50, you know, £1.50. You get at the last stop. Then you take the next bus, come back. So if it's a longish bus route, so you're talking about 3 hours or something, mm-hmm. you know, or 2 hours, 2.5 hours. That's a solid amount of chunk of time.
That's great.
With, yeah, pram in the hall, I don't go either way on this because each one's circumstances are different and so on and so forth. So the question is about what you want. You know, we wanted children. Does it mean you don't have the right to moan and complain? No, it doesn't. You can still be whine and moan and complain, what the hell have I done? You know, so on and so forth. But you wanted kids and you loved them. And you know why you wanted them, you know. So you have to work around those things. Sometimes it's frustrating, of course. That would be dishonest. You know, you're just finally sitting down and you open your laptop or your notebook and you have your pens, you're ready, and then that's exactly, precisely when your daughter says, I need a wee. Dad, I need the bathroom. You know, so it is trying. Your patience is tested. But you chose to do it. Nobody forced you to have kids. Nobody forced you to be a writer either.
This is true.
You know? So nobody forced you to be a parent and a writer together. So deal with it. Mm-hmm. You know, to whatever extent, you know, whichever way you can. So I go we're lucky we live near two very large parks. So I take long walks in that park. It's a kind of park I like. It's got everything. It's got a wooded area. It's got a forest. It's got a lake. It's got a playing area. It's got open spaces, and it's got a sports bit as well. You know, it's in London, which is one of the things I really like about London is this. So literally, 2 minutes walk from my house, I'm in wilderness. I'm in the forest. I can actually choose not to go to the main area of the park, but go into the wood. I used to go to the parks back before as well. You know, but because this is precious time where you do a bit for thinking, or you clear your head, or or as we all know, writing can be very, very difficult sometimes. Things don't work, you know. You spend enough time, you spend 4 months, 5 months, or whatever amount of time on something, and it's not working.
And if you were given a magic wand and could transform something about the publishing industry, what would you change?
I think I would ask them to go back to the era when editors, publishers would support a writer from their early careers through to at least their middle age. You know, because when you're starting out, you know, you're not sure of your craft and, you know, you're of self-doubt and so on and so forth. And back in the day, publishers used to kind of, you know, support a writer through all that until, because from their first books to their third books, fourth books, fifth books, and they saw them become the writers they become, evolve as writers. And the writers need that. That there's, it's not about money alone. You don't have to throw a lot of money at them. Just enough to keep them afloat, or just enough to keep them, to keep publishing them. I think that was a good model. It was not a bad thing. And it's not difficult to go back to it, you know, because they do make money, publishers. And yeah, that's what they're for. They're corporations. They have to make money. Somebody's, you know, making investments. They have to get, I'll get that. And if they can, you know, somehow find ways of supporting writers a little more than they used to with regard to, you know, looking at their careers. I haven't thought enough about, you know, this practice of, you know, when there are debut writers, they're hot and they get, you know, they are given these advances and so on and so forth. And then in some cases, you don't see them again or you don't hear of them again. I don't know if that's a good model, but I'm not very knowledgeable on the subject. You know, but these are my feelings. This is what I think, you know, if you don't have to give fat advances to these, that to support them. And the big test, obviously, always, you know, we say readers want this. No, readers are an entirely different entity. They're far more intelligent and nuanced and complex than we give them credit for, you know. You know, when we talk about this mythical reader, or reader says, reader doesn't want it, what does that mean? Readers exist in all shapes and sizes and, you know, forms, you know, and in my experience, in my brief experience as a writer, I find the readers are way more, are way sharper and intelligent than we sometimes give them credit for when we, you know, talk about readers. Oh, they will reject this. No, you know, they're not merely customers, or they're not just merely paying consumers. They're slightly more than that, is what I like to think. So readers will support writers, I think, you know.
Well, let's hope so.
The magic wand, yes, I think I would go back to that time. I would ask publishers, I'm not saying go back to the time when you would just do throw away £80,000 or £100,000 at a young writer. No, I'm talking about look at their work and see how you can sustain their work, how you can sustain their careers, mm-hmm. how we can help them sustain mm-hmm. their careers. You know.
And what are your hopes for your career?
I think I'd like to keep it simple. I'd like to be able to write a book every 3-4 years. You know, are my only conditions, I would like to write the books I want to write. You know, if that requires me to, yeah, make less, a little bit of less money, or requires me to kind of, you know, work more slowly, or, you know, then that's fine. I would like to write the kind of book. So not that you have lined up, you know, you have thought about all the books you want to write. So if, for instance, you've written book 3, this is what you wanted to do, and this is what you thought you will do. And then, you know, I want to write a fourth novel, which is going to be about a woman in East London who's British Asian origin, but she's a British woman, you know, and she's a working class mother. And she's lived in somewhere near Walthamstow, and she becomes friends with a posh white boy. And those are those two worlds. But I don't want to just do the collision of the worlds. I want to write about the woman. You know? So I've told myself I'm going to write it from her point of view, no matter what. You know? Yes, if when I do it and I find it's not working, then obviously I'll, you know, reconsider my goal. But I've been thinking about this for a year now. A year and a half, maybe. And I've, you know, written loose bits here and there. So I'm convinced, no, everything has to be from her point of view. You know, this middle-aged former dinner lady from East London. And yeah, she breaks all the stereotypes that one would have of a British Asian woman living in East London somewhere, you know, in North East London, you know, somewhere. Yeah, I want to be, I'm sort of, you know, drawn to this kind of person. So to answer your question, so I want to be able to write that. That's all I want in life for now. You know, yeah. I want to write about Maryam is her name. Mm-hmm. I want to write her fully and complete, sort of, you know, in all her, with all her contradictions and flaws and charms and beauty and rough edges and nastiness and but amazing grace and dignity and sharp tongue. And I want to see how that works. So I'll do whatever. I mean, obviously you can't do everything, you have kids, you know, but I'll do whatever is possible in my capacity to be able to write that novel, you know. Now then, whether somebody will publish it, whether they will pay me, I can't think of that now. That's my simple goal in life.
Sounds good to me. Mirza, thank you so much.
Thank you for talking to me. That was amazing.
That was Mirza Wahid in conversation with Anne Morgan. You can find out more about Mirza on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 307, which was recorded by Anne Morgan and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 308, Shyama Pereira speaks with Anne Morgan about journalism versus fiction, racism, and her love of music and teaching. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.